From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. A new report says debit card use has climbed fourfold in the past 10 years. It's also been predicted that banknotes and coins will be used for fewer than half of all transactions in the next 5 years. This hour, we examine the prospects for a cashless society with University of Iowa finance professor and former senior advisor at the Federal Reserve, John Spitzer. Also, media theorist and author Douglas Ruschkoff and Ben Milne, the leader of a Des Moines business offering a web-based technology for transferring money. Could you, would you, do you go cashless? Join our discussion after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new report says debit card use has climbed fourfold in the past 10 years. It's also been predicted that banknotes and coins will be used for fewer than half of all transactions in the next 5 years. So this hour, we examine the demise of physical currency and the prospects for a cashless society. Joining us first of all this hour, Douglas Ruschkoff. He is a media theorist, writer, columnist, lecturer, author of 10 books, including his latest, Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. Douglas Ruschkoff, welcome to our program, joining us from New York City.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Douglas Ruschkoff currently teaches in the Media Studies Department at the New School University in Manhattan. Joining us in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, John Spitzer, a University of Iowa finance professor, former senior economist at the Federal Reserve. Welcome to you, Professor Spitzer.
Nice to be here.
Mr. Ruschkoff, let me start with you. Start off by giving us some historical context in our physical currency. How did we start using the coins and banknotes we've had for generations?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends how far back you go. The Egyptians were using shards of pottery, and then late Middle Ages they were using little stamped foil, and there were coins in the Roman Empire, but I guess what we're talking about more is sort of this centralized borrowed currency. And that really, I guess, the kind of money we use today really came into use in the late Middle Ages. The feudal lords and the early kind of proto kings and waning aristocracy of the late Middle Ages were getting quite upset that there was so much peer-to-peer value exchange going on. You know, people and merchants were getting wealthy while the kings and their friends were staying the same or getting poorer. So they really made all peer-to-peer money systems illegal and forced people instead to use what they called coin of the realm, which was, you know, coinage that was, you know, centrally issued from a national treasury rather than, you know, created by towns or people out of, you know, based on how much grain they had brought into the grain store. Mm-hmm. You know, and those monies were definitely biased differently. These were, you know, scarcity biased currencies that only so much would be issued, and hopefully people would be, you know, competing over that scarce currency.
What about when we fast forward to the last couple of hundred years, specifically American currency? What stands out in your mind when we speak of that?
Well, I guess, you know, the big moments were, you know, at one point, you know, our currency was supposed to represent some piece of gold or silver somewhere. You know, you could trade it in and get this other stuff, which isn't necessarily that gold or silver has any real value, you know, either. It's not like, you know, you're on a desert island and you're hungry. A piece of gold isn't really going to do anything for you either. You know, there's some industrial application, but that's not what, you know, these things are they're not really commodities as such. Their value is based purely in that they're thought to be scarce. But around Nixon time, through a series of innovations, the dollar was taken off the gold standard altogether. So it was really the value of gold or value of money was, you know, related really purely to to what people think it's worth, or to, you know, how much of it is put into circulation.
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean now when we reach this tipping point of sorts, that the prediction that fewer than half of all transactions in the next 5 years will be done without banknotes and coins? This is something that is quite different than we've seen for generations, maybe even arguing back to the Egyptians, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, yes and no. I mean, in the end, it doesn't really matter so much whether the paper is there or not. As if we're still denominating the transactions in dollars, you know, they can move back and forth, you know, more quickly. But all it really means is that, you know, we're going to be paying 1, 2, or 3% to whoever is monitoring those transactions. You know, it's a good thing for Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, you know, for whoever administrates those transactions. You know, where it gets interesting, and even, you know, Alan Greenspan was alluding to this in one of his latest, you know, testimonies to Congress, or the later ones, is that when it gets interesting is if money does become electronic, it takes some of the magical totemic value away from what we think of as real money, as real currency. And we will, I really do believe, we'll start to see competitive currencies. Now, once it is all in the electronic realm, you know, which currency you trust may not always be the one that's issued by a central bank. That people will start to find privately issued currencies a very attractive and sometimes a more efficient way of doing transactions.
Professor John Spitzer, a finance professor at the University of Iowa, you worked for the Federal Reserve in the late 1970s, and you began, even then, I find this fascinating, the investigation into a cashless society. Where was it in the 1970s, these thoughts?
Yeah, it was an interesting time. The Federal Reserve, give you a little background, at that time they provided the payments services free of charge to their members, services namely clearing checks and also providing currency to them. So there was a great push at the Fed to reduce these costs, and computers had just come of age. So the one big push, we did two things that proved pretty successful. One was to push to eliminate checks. At that time, the Fed was flying checks all over the country.
What's
every
so bad
night.
About checks?
It just takes a lot of they're expensive, as I
you
say.
You have to push them physically around.
You have to carry them around, and I say, we want to clear them quickly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Iowa, back in those days, we had a bad episode of a big meat packer who went broke and had issued checks. They were drawn on remote locations, and farmers didn't realize that they weren't getting paid until they got, returned for insufficient funds, mm-hmm. about a month later. Mm. So for a payments mechanism, you want to get this stuff cleared fast, and it's expensive to do so. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, with the computers, take that information and backtrack just a little bit. You have to remember that money, as it is, has been now for some hundreds of years, is a claim. It's a claim on an asset. So my currency, that's a claim on assets of the Federal Reserve.
No intrinsic value. It's just a representation.
Well, it's a representation. It doesn't have intrinsic value in the way that gold does. Right. But it has value. And here I get into arguments with some of my other economist friends who say that the Federal Reserve currency is valuable just because you have to take it. I don't think so. The Federal Reserve, you have a claim on their balance sheet, and they got a lot of valuable stuff, not even including the land they have.
Right.
So we did push on both of those fronts at that time.
What do you see as the tipping point here, as significant in the fact that more of the transactions increasingly are cashless now?
I think the big tipping point was the advances in computers and computers everywhere, and the internet connection. Banks now offer a service here in Iowa City. I was talking with a friend yesterday. For merchants who are not convenient to the bank, they have checks they want to deposit. They can use their PC with a scanner, scan in the checks that just came in today, send that electronically to the bank, and have it cleared.
Okay. We wanted to sample some opinion about going cashless in our society. So we sent out Iowa Public Radio's Christina Sarnelli to the streets of Iowa City to talk to a few people. Let's listen.
I'm Alex Lodge. I'm from Coushatta, Louisiana.
Okay, Alex, what do you think of our country becoming a cashless nation?
I think that it would probably lead to more fiscal irresponsibility, given the current economic problems that we have now with overspending, taking out loans, buying houses that we can't really afford. I think by not having a tangible means of currency, that takes away our mindset on balancing our own checkbooks, making sure we keep account of how much money we're holding.
Do you think you spend more on credit cards, or do you carry cash around with you more often?
I do neither. I have a debit card, which I think is probably the better better alternative if you're not going to carry cash, because that way you can still track the amount of money that you spend.
My name is Chris, and I'm from Iowa City.
Okay, Chris, what do you think of our culture becoming a more cashless culture where we depend more on credit cards than cash?
Well, I think it is a pretty dangerous habit to get into. When you have a credit card, it seems that you spend more when you use the credit card versus if you had cash, you have a limited set amount of money.
I just feel if I don't have the cash to pay for it, I don't need to put it on credit. I prefer cash.
What do you think the consequences are of our culture becoming more dependent on credit cards than cash?
I think there's too many people in the hole, you know, overall. Maybe more bankruptcies sooner down the line.
Tony, Waukegan, Illinois. The fact that we use, you know, credit cards and debit cards, it's easier. You don't have to carry cash around, and you can't get robbed of cash. And so it's a good thing. If someone steals your credit cards or debit cards, you can just go to the company that issued them and get new ones.
Megan
from
Clarinda. Okay. I don't own any credit cards, but I use my debit card for pretty much everything. And I feel that that's just as good as cash. I mean, but then credits are good for building up credit and saving or being able to use your money in the future.
Do you carry around cash at all?
Yeah.
What do you use it for mostly?
Parking garages really is all I use my cash for. Otherwise, I always use my debit card.
Iowa Public Radio's Christina Sarnelli on the streets of Iowa City talking to people about our move towards a cashless society. And we want to get a reaction from our guests to perhaps some of the things that were said in that Vox Pop. Also reactions from you, our listeners. Are you mourning the demise of physical coins and banknotes? Or have you stopped carrying cash altogether? We'd like to hear your story. Is it harder or easier to save or stay within a budget without cash? Tell us about your relationship with money when we come back. Right now, you can call 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Talking about our cashless society, we'll be right back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. Back on The Exchange, talking about the demise of our physical currency, the pros and cons of our move towards a cashless society. University of Iowa finance professor, former senior advisor, senior economist at the Federal Reserve, John Spitzer is with us. Also media theorist and author Douglas Rushkoff. And he is author of 10 books, including the latest, Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. I want to ask about the opinions we heard before we go to the phones in just a few minutes. We heard out on the streets with those opinions gathered, people to a certain extent seeing a connection between overspending and indebtedness and our becoming a cashless society. Professor Spitzer, is that borne out in reality, these concerns?
Well, I think there are legitimate concerns there. I would split it into two parts. One is purely the borrowing part, and with credit cards, I have the opportunity to borrow, and I have the opportunity to get over my head. And that is a problem for many people. The other type of electronics, a debit card, I can't get over my head because it has to be the money in my account.
You've got a bottom there.
So I have a bottom there. I think I would agree with some of the interview people that having that physical part does psychologically help a bit. I don't have it in my pocket. I won't spend it.
That's what struck me about it as well, and perhaps you can comment, Douglas Wooshkoff. People seem to have a great deal of self-awareness about how they spend differently with cash than with electronic funds.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of work in behavioral finance that shows, you know, the different people think of the money in their pocket as different from the money in their bank account, as different from the money in their deep savings. You know, there's sort of different frameworks go around each of those kinds of things. And even the amount of money that you're willing to overspend on one thing might exceed the amount you're willing to, you know, overspend on another thing based on the context. And certainly the card and even the fees are something that seems like something you're going to have to deal with later. And if you have to deal with it later, it seems smaller. Mm. You know, the thing that I was interested in was that the first thing I thought was going to come up on the street was people's concern for privacy. You know, people talk about the net and they're slowly becoming aware of how everything they do, you know, online is traceable. I'm kind of surprised that people aren't concerned that, you know, with less and less cash transactions, that more and more of their more and more of their purchases, more and more of their financial activity is being recorded by all sorts of people, whether it's governments or corporations, to be used for whatever purpose is in those 90-page agreements.
Mm-hmm. We'll see if we get some of those comments to that effect when we reach out to our listeners. 1-866-780-9100 or email us theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. David is on the road. Where are you driving, David? I hope you're safely using your phone.
Yeah, I'm safe. I'm driving south to Dubuque. But what I have found, my wife and I have found that the cash flows through our fingers, and if we use debit and credit, then we're able to track our purchases, and we've been doing this over a number of years now so that we can, at different times, we sit down, look at our transactions, and we're able to go, okay, we've spent too much on this particular item, maybe we want to spend more on another, or we can move money into savings. We can then see, it's just an analysis of how we spend, and we're aware of that, and the credit debit that we use is our avenue for tracking that. With cash is stuff you blow through, we found. Mm-hmm. And with regard to the secrecy or the identity problem or the issue, I actually like that people could track my what I spend money on, because then I will draw more people to the attention of more corporations or more people. And then I might find better deals. I might find better travel deals. Or if I spend money on wine, as an example, I might be attracting those people. So I have no issues with regard to the identity.
Interesting arguments. David, thank you for calling. Let's move quickly before our break to Charlie. Charlie in Des Moines. Charlie, are you there?
Interesting arguments. David, thank you for calling. Let's move quickly before our break to Charlie.
Whoops, we've got a little technical problem there. Let's go to John in North Liberty. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
Yes, go ahead. We've got a few minutes before the break. What's on your mind?
Great. Well, I'm a very conservative spender, and we have actually found a way to make money monthly using credit cards. We rarely, if ever, carry cash. We have a card that has no fee and provides a percentage of cash back for purchases made, and we pay our balance off every month.
Mm-hmm. So you feel it like doing a little bit of extra work gains you a little bit of money?
It does.
Interesting. There are all kinds of little loopholes here in the credit cards. Can John Spitzer, can you tell us about the credit cards and all the different types there are out there and how you, like John in North Liberty, could be making money with your credit card?
Yeah, nice point that John makes there, and it's something that the merchants have a great deal of difficulty with right now. They are required to honor all credit cards that are issued by a credit card maker, and all credit cards are not the same. Some have cash back, some have miles for flights, et cetera, et cetera. And the merchant receives a different amount of a discount depending on what kind of card was used. and they're prohibited from making any adjustment. They can't put surcharges on somebody who's using a card that has a jillion miles and a lot of cash back.
So when you're handing your card, whatever it may be, American mm-hmm, Express, mm-hmm. Discover, Visa, over, yeah. The merchant sees it through different eyes than you do.
They sure do. And in particular, talking with one of the finance people at a local merchant here in Iowa City, she commented, when somebody pays with a credit card, we don't know how much money we're going to get. We don't mm-hmm. find that out until it clears. Because there are all these types. So it's a two-edged sword. It's good for people who can use it. On the other hand, it is coming out in a certain extent from the merchants.
Douglas Rushkoff joining us from New York City. I know you have to leave us in just a few moments as we go into our break. I wanted to throw it to you and ask, how does our move toward becoming a cashless society, away from physical currency, fit in with the theme of your latest book, Life, Inc., which is a condemnation of how corporate culture has disconnected human beings from each other?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, on the one hand, you know, the last caller was really talking about something bigger than he might realize. The idea of saying it's actually cool to surrender all this information because then, you know, the machine, the network, will be able to provide me with a better, more highly granularized versions of that which I really want. In other words, the more it knows about me, the more it's going to be able to please me. There's another side to that, which is that the more the network knows about me, the more I'm going to behave in ways that are predictable to the network. In other words, in some sense, you get more choice, and in some sense, you end up really just honing your Facebook profile into, you know, ever more exact versions of what you already are.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying, we have about a minute or so, and you're saying the danger here that the caller might want to make himself more aware of is
these machines are very good at seeing you as you just were, as seeing the last you that was. But they're not necessarily really good at understanding where is your free will, where is the you of tomorrow. In other words, and as the record of what you've done becomes more and more pronounced and accessible, your past can become a much more dominant force in how you operate than your future.
As it accumulates, your past accumulates,
you sort of lug
around your past history, is what you're saying.
It's always there. When you spend money, you spend your money. You might have the thing, but the purchase is gone. You know, now it's part of your. It's on your permanent record. Put it that way.
Douglas Rushkoff, thank you very much. We have to go. Media theorist and author. His latest book is titled Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. Douglas Rushkoff, thank you for joining us from New York City.
Take care.
You too. And we'd like to reach out to our listeners. Professor Spitzer will be joining us, staying with us rather, in the second half hour. And we'll have another guest as well. We'd like to have you chime in on this theme. Are you mourning the demise of physical coins and banknotes? Have you stopped carrying cash altogether? Are you using the machine, the network, or are you worried about that machine having all the information about your purchases when you do so only electronically? We'd like to hear your story, your relationship with money. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. It's The Exchange. We'll be back in a few minutes. With The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. And tomorrow on this program, Des Moines Register columnist Kathy Obradovich will be joining us, as well as Cedar Rapids Gazette political reporter James Lynch, to discuss the last gubernatorial debate before the June primary and Vice President Joe Biden's trip to Iowa to endorse Governor Culver. Also, Iowa Public Radio's All Things Considered host Pat Blank discusses the Dalai Lama's visit to the University of northern Iowa. If you were there, tune in tomorrow to share your observations about the Dalai Lama's visit this week, tomorrow on The Exchange. Today we're talking about the demise of physical currency, the tendency towards a cashless society, the pros and cons of a cashless society. Are you mourning the demise of physical coins and banknotes? Or have you stopped carrying cash altogether and you're happy about it? 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. John Spitzer, University of Iowa finance professor with us, former senior economist at the Federal Reserve. And before we do go to callers and another guest, Professor Spitzer, how did we get started with electronic payments in this country?
Yeah, go back to what our most of our money is, the money that's in my bank. That's a claim on the bank. So when I want to pay somebody, I need to transfer that claim to that other person. So it sort of bends your mind a little bit, but it's all an information system. So I tell my bank, no, reduce what you owe me by $100 and transfer that to this other person, either through a series of other banks or whatever is done. So it's this information flowing. And with the computers coming a little bit of age back in when I was there in the late Stone Age.
In the
1970s. Said, gosh, we can just capture all that information and move it electronically instead of using checks. So 1974 was the start of the automated clearinghouse, ACH. Uh-huh. And that system really developed and became fully operational nationwide, I think, 1978. And this allowed people to pay by just transferring the information, and it was computer to computer. And what that has done over the years, things have piggybacked on the ACH system and a few others. And it's allowed entrepreneurial types to come up with new kinds of payments systems that at the bottom use the ACH or one of the other similar mechanisms there.
Now, at that time in the 1970s, because it was something so much new and people had to get used to this idea of not having something physically to give to someone, mm-hmm. were there worries, concerns at that time that this was a dramatic change and perhaps not a change for the better?
Well, I can give you a good illustration of that concern. The group I worked with was the Reserve Bank Operations Payments Mechanism, and the director of that was a man named Jim Kudlinski. And we were in his office one day talking about our efforts to get automatic deposit instead of paychecks. Mm-hmm. And that's when we had secretaries everywhere. And Jim's secretary came in and said, Jim, here's your check. And we looked at it, Jim, check? And he looked at us and got this sheepish smile on his face and said, I don't trust those guys.
The guy instituting it did not trust electronic transfer. Joining us now is Ben Milne. He is the founder of Dwolla. That's a Des Moines business focusing on web-based technology oriented towards transferring cash, the latest incarnation of this electronic payment. He's joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Ben, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. What is Dwolla?
Well, I think an easy way to understand Dwolla is just kind of to say PayPal without the fees. It allows two people to exchange money electronically, but it doesn't have the same fees that PayPal does. You can utilize it pretty much over the web.
Mm-hmm. So if I want to start paying Dwolla, what type of person would most benefit from using Dwolla?
There's definitely a couple different ones. You know, you have consumers and you have merchants. So right now we see most of our traction in Iowa being with merchants, a lot in business-to-business transactions where the merchants are finding it has multiple applications. So they can get paid from consumers. They can distribute it through payroll to their employees. They can pay other businesses. And really do all the things at a very low cost. Sorry, go ahead.
So people, if I'm an employee at a company in Iowa, they may ask that I be paid via Dwolla.
Yes, definitely.
Hmm. What led to the establishment of your company?
My old company. I used to own a company called Elemental Design that is based out of Newton, Iowa, which is kind of strange listening to all this stuff going on with TPI. And we got paid through our website. That's how we got paid for everything. We were an online company. And once we really started to scale, and once we passed about $1 million a year, we started looking at interchange costs, and that was really frustrating because once we started looking for other payment systems to utilize on our website, we found that there really wasn't one that allowed us to get paid electronically without paying the interchange.
Mm-hmm. So who does this cut out? Because we've learned in our first half hour that electronic transfers are great because financial institutions like to earn money on that money flowing around here. Mm-hmm. Who are you cutting out, Ben?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that really the biggest reason we don't have the same cost is because we don't use the same interchange networks. Which is to say, you know, the Vital network and things like that. But I also think it's important to mention that the way we utilize electronic transfers or the way we move money, there isn't any debt in our system. So there's nobody that needs to underwrite the transaction like there is with a credit card. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have the same cost that we have to deal with. So we really just roll those savings over to the end user, the consumer, and the merchants.
Professor Spitzer, what are your observations about this service, Dwolla, and ones like it?
Well, I'm interested in it. Ben, tell me, I'm assuming that somebody who makes a payment has an account with a depository institution.
Yeah, I think that the fundamental mechanism here is that, you know, money moves from one bank account to another bank account. And whether or not you're utilizing cash, credit, or check, I mean, that's the mechanism either way.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in terms of the backbone that you use that transfers that information from the bank that I have where I have my deposit to the merchant's bank where mm-hmm. I want the money to go, what is it that connects those two?
Well, that's ACH. You know, use the term piggyback on the ACH system, and I'm smiling right now mm-hmm. Because that's a term I use often is we piggyback on the ACH system. Mm-hmm. And really that's one of the things that's really unique about our company is how we utilize the ACH system and how we've built our technology to communicate with it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any concerns in operating Dwolla about security, identity theft, theft of electronic money? How do you assure that that's not going to happen?
Well, I mean, in any financial exchange, you have that risk exposure. And I think that the biggest one is know your customer. And you have to have some sort of fraud mitigation that's implemented on the front end. Your bank does that when you open an account. We do that when you open an account. Visa and MasterCard do that when you open an account. And really, the best thing you can do is really just do your best to know your customer.
Mm. Okay. Please stay with us, Ben, joining us from Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Let's go back to our calls. What are your concerns? What comes to mind when you hear this conversation? Tell us about your relationship with money. 1-866-780-9100. Email theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Jack is in Des Moines. Jack, good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I have a couple of things on my mind listening to this very interesting conversation. The first thing that's always been a concern of mine is if we take cash out of the system and go only on a privately owned non-cash basis, what then do we have to ensure that we always have access to our money? At any time, a private company can restrict my access to the money in the way that the government can't. There's no place I can go to actually get my cash out then. Mm. I'm totally dependent on private companies to make sure that I have access to my money. And secondly, the privacy concerns are huge. There's no such thing as an anonymous donation anymore. When you use the system to make these contributions, say to a political party, everybody will know exactly who you donated to. And there's no way to keep that kind of information private. So thank you very much, and I'll listen on the air.
Two great questions, Jack, from Des Moines. Let's tackle the access. Of course, nobody's going to block you if you have your money in a mattress, but if it's not even existing in a bank for you to withdraw, Professor Spitzer.
The caller makes a good point there, and I think many of us have heard of people where in a joint account and things aren't set up quite right and one party dies, and sometimes you have trouble getting your money out. But let me back up just a second. We haven't said this on the air yet, but I don't think there's any real risk that currency is going to disappear. It's continuing to grow. There's a nice little chart that the St. Louis Fed puts out. It's on the web. I looked at it last night. Currency in circulation has been doubling about every 10 years since way back. So the currency, I don't think it's going to disappear. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that for most of us, making large payments, currency just doesn't work well. And in fact, if you try to make a really large payment with currency, then you're going to get a lot of questions.
You attract a lot of attention to yourself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A suitcase full of bills, right?
Right.
Okay. Let's go to this email. Interesting. Jenny in Altoona writes, I still put money into envelopes every month and operate roughly 50% of my budget via the cash envelope system. Mostly groceries, toiletries, everyday expenses. It helps me control spending because when the cash is gone, I am done. We heard earlier from a caller that said it worked exactly the opposite for him, that he and his wife found it easier to save, easier to track where the money was going when it was electronic. So here we see it really fits the type of person that you are, Professor Spitzer.
Yeah, I think you have it right. Different people will use it differently. One of the big things about currency, and what's the caller mentioned this, it's a store of value. And give you one of my favorite stories that I tell all of my classes. Back when I was at the Fed, every year at Easter time, we couldn't ship $100 bills down to El Paso and San Antonio fast enough. It all went, and after Easter, it all came back. And what was going on was, many years before that, the Mexican government had devalued the peso, and they did it over the Easter holiday. And my colleagues and I thought that was the stupidest thing ever, that these people remembered that. And what they're doing is they were converting their pesos into $100 bills, wait and see if it's going to be devalued. If it's not devalued, then cross the border and get your pesos back.
Another interesting chapter that you were involved with was, of course, we remember the Susan B. Anthony dollars, the Thomas Jefferson $2 bills. I don't think it would be hard to find one of those these days, wouldn't it?
It's hard to find. Those didn't succeed, and I'm a pain to confess. I looked at the prototype of the Susan B. Anthony coin and said, this is really going to work well. And I was involved at the time with the $2 bill. They didn't work well. The $2 bill didn't work because the bottleneck is at the merchant, the cash drawer. And that's valuable space. If the $2 bill is going to succeed, they have to make a space for it because they need to use it to make change. Well, it was high use, and they chose not to do that. The Susan B. Anthony coin suffered from its size. There were only a few size slots open because of the vending machines, things that were where other coins could be used, like a 5-cent piece. You can't make that into a dollar coin because the vending machine people would be mad. And the size that was selected, while on absolute terms it had a good differential, in relative terms it wasn't enough, and people couldn't tell the difference between that and the quarter.
Yeah. Very close.
They were
to
pretty
the quarter.
Close.
Interesting background there. Audrey is joining us from Cedar Rapids. Do you go cashless, Audrey?
No, actually, I'm with the caller that uses the envelope system.
Oh.
Because I do not have, I like to shop. I don't like to shop, but I like to overspend sometimes, I'll admit it. And the cash system is just, it keeps me out of trouble.
Hmm. What if, let's do a what if, a sci-fi scenario for you, Audrey, and play into your, maybe a fear of yours. What if the government announced in 10 years, we will have no more cash, Audrey, so you better change your ways.
Well, I'd have a problem with that because our household income, a good portion of it, comes from cash.
For instance?
For instance, we own a vending route.
Okay, so vending machine's a problem.
What are you going to do with all those vendors that strictly take cash? That doesn't include me. That includes people like the Coney Dogs and stuff like that, or Coney Island, and all of that. Cash is a necessity, I think. And I think we've gotten in over our head with credit, period, the end.
John Spitzer, do you see a time when cash will be completely gone for society, or will Audrey always have a chance to reach out for some?
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. As I say, it's been growing. One of the things that was striking to me as a young person at the Federal Reserve was the Federal Reserve was completely opposed to doing any kind of tinkering with the currency, with the monetary system. We had several people at that time who had memories of Germany in the 1920s, and it had stuck with them. So they wouldn't do anything. And I think a good demonstration of that is we still have pennies. Pennies, we recognize them as being kind of obsolete back in the 1970s. They're worth a heck of a lot less now, but they're still there. I don't see any movement that has any legs
Though you regularly find them in garbage cans, and people scarcely bend over to pick them up on the street anymore. Mm-hmm. Audrey, thank you very much for joining us from Cedar Rapids. No fears about cash disappearing. Thanks, Audrey. Let's go to Karen in back to Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Yes. Given, I don't think any of us think that the credit card business is going to go away. So my question is, are there people working on strategies to teach young people what it means, you know, how this whole system of credit cards and such works? In other words, and high school students often have to take some kind of a consumer economics class where they have to make out a budget. They have to grasp the concepts of paying bills and living independently and so on. And I think we've seen, or heard about at least, the failures of this. People who are in over their heads, they know they don't have the money. They continue to use credit cards, et cetera, when they know they can't pay the bill at the end of the month. And so are there people developing strategies to work with the reality that we have become are becoming a cashless society?
Right. So we are less manipulated by the big financial institutions into parting with some of our money.
Correct.
John Spitzer, do you see that?
There's a lot of effort going on in that area. I haven't been involved with it, but we get a lot of calls from people who are looking for help, people in the high schools. The caller has it exactly correct. This is an area of great importance for young people to learn to handle money, to manage money.
Karen, joining us from Des Moines, thank you very much. I want to go to Ben Milne, founder of Dwolla, this business focusing on web-based technology towards transferring cash. Ben, where do you see yourself 5 or 10 years from now in developing your business?
You know, that's a great question. I think in 5 or 10 years, I'd be amazed if I was still a part of the business. You know, I think that the detachment or attachment to actual physical currency is, you know, something that none of us really, I don't think, fully understand. But at the same time, businesses like mine, which is to say that it really focus on electronic currency, so to speak, are not going to go away. I think they'll become more prevalent, and by concentrating on, you know, behavior like integrating into cell phones or integrating with cards or whatever those protocols are, I think that there's a tremendous amount of value to products like ours to the market.
Mm-hmm. Why are you based in Des Moines? Electronic banking doesn't need a geographic site, does it?
Being based in Des Moines, I met a guy by the name of Joey Hinkey about 6 months ago. And after a couple introductions from Joe, I met some other people, and then I met some other people, and those meetings just continued, and I stayed in Des Moines. Des Moines kind of giving me access to everything our company needs right now, and the access to banking and financial markets and products is absolutely unbelievable here.
How many Dwolla-like companies are out there in the U.S.?
Oh, that's exactly like us.
Similar to
I'd like to
competitors do you have out there, Ben?
You know, I think you could say PayPal, Obelpay, you know, those are really big ones. And then there's probably dozens of others that are kind of trying to make their mark like we are. Mm-hmm. You know, some people see banks as competitors, which I don't. Some people see credit cards as competitors. I don't. And I think that our technology, what we really concentrate on is being a cash equivalent to electronic transactions, which is not something that anyone else is really doing. We're first.
How many users do you have?
That's something that for now we're kind of keeping quiet.
Keeping quiet? Why?
Our technology is very new. We are dealing with a lot of potential fraud. And right now our platform is not really something that we're scaling nationally. We're just doing it here locally in Iowa. And there's not really a whole lot of benefit us to really pushing out or saying we have 1 million users or anything like that, because we simply don't. And that's not in our master plan.
Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to tell us what the biggest kink is you're trying to work out of this new system of payment?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I mean, you really need to make sure that you're compliant with a lot of banking regulation. It's complicated. It's expensive. And right now we're just working through it.
Okay, I want to thank you for joining us, Ben Milne, founder of Dwolla. People are interested in the spelling of that. It's D-W-O-L-L-A, correct?
Yep, D-W-O-L-L-A.
Very good. Ben, thanks for joining us. I want to turn to Professor John Spitzer with the final word today. So when we can sum up how our move toward a cashless society is shaping us, is changing us, things to be aware of, what would you leave us with as a final thought, Professor Spitzer?
Oh, gracious, a final thought. I'm not accustomed to that sort of thing. I think the final thought is I don't think currency is going away, but the growth of the electronics is much more rapid, and it's not going away either. Most of us are making those payments in some form or another already. There are concerns broadly about privacy. I don't worry about that too much. Maybe I should worry about it a little bit more. And the electronics part has clearly improved our payments mechanism, and that's very good for the economy.
Okay, we'll check back in as our cashless society develops. Thank you very much for joining us this hour. John Spitzer, University of Iowa finance professor, former senior economist at the Federal Reserve. Thanks for coming in today.
Good to be here. Thanks.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Production assistants from Rosalind Sixby. Also thanks to John Pemble in Des Moines. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks so much for all of the calls today and tomorrow. Remember, our Reporters Roundtable. So if you have some news, recent news in the state that you'd like to discuss, tune in to The Exchange tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.